各位观众朋友，大家好，欢迎收看美国之音 VOA 卫视的时事大家谈，我是宇宙。过去几个月，在各种大型国际会议上，各国领导人都同意应对气候变化是重中之重，各国必须携手合作应对气候危机。来自犹他州的美国国会共和党众议员邝锡恒 John Curtis 最近成立了保守气候变化事务议员团，希望通过私有部门的创新和投资帮助解决气候变化问题。该议员团相信气候变化是个全球性议题，需要所有国家共同合作，尤其是中国。美国之音英语节目 Press Conference USA 主持人卡罗尔·卡斯蒂尔最近专访了邝锡恒议员，请他做进一步说明。邝锡恒议员是众议院中国工作组成员，在2020年的一个报告中，这个小组表示，中共是美国这一代所面临的最大的国家安全和经济挑战。最近，邝锡恒议员和另外几名两党议员提出议案，支持台湾参与国际事务。邝锡恒议员会说中文，他特意录制了一段视频，向中国大陆的美国之音的观众问好。
我的中国朋友，我今天很高兴有这个机会跟你们谈话。我希望你们知道我好想我中国的朋友，希望我们能够跟在一起做更好的事情。谢谢你们。
下面请看专访内容。
Congressman Curtis, thank you for speaking with VOA.
Thank you, Carol. It's been too long. Let's not wait so long next time.
Sounds good to me.Congressman Curtis, under former President Donald Trump, many in the Republican Party either denied or minimized the impacts of climate change. The Pew Research Center recently reported that approximately 72% of Democrats believe that human activity contributes to climate change. This as opposed to only 22% of Republicans. Congressman, to what do you attribute this discrepancy?Between the two political parties over the causes and impacts of climate change.
I really regret that Republicans have allowed ourselves to be branded as either denying science or not caring about the environment. I actually personally don't believe for most of us that's actually true. And like so many things, those on the extremes and the ones that are loudest tend to get all the attention.And my experience by talking about climate as a Republican has been very well received. And I'm finding so many of my colleagues that actually agree with me.
So what prompted you, Congressman Curtis, from the beautiful state of Utah to create a separate conservative climate caucus for Republicans only? How does it differ, for example, from the bipartisan Climate Solutions Caucus?
Well, first, I just want to underscore that it is an amazing, beautiful state. And,quite frankly, probably has a little bit to do, maybe a lot to do with my view of protecting the climate and the environment. Now, to more specifically answer your question, I feel like as I've kind of watched what's happening is that a couple of things are unfolding, and that is that Republicans have allowed ourselves by our silence to be branded as not caring about the environment. And to be frank, I don't think we havespent enough time educating Republican members of Congress, talking about these issues and our solutions. And so therefore, while I think a bipartisan group is extremely important, I also think a partisan group of Republicans, meaning that they're just Republicans, is very, very healthy to a broader dialogue because we have been missing from the dialogue. We need to start with some real basics about our ideas and our solutions.And so we can bring those forward to the bipartisan group. And instead of coming with just Democratic ideas, which we normally oppose, bring ideas of our own.
Congressman Curtis, President Biden has elevated climate change to the top of his domestic and foreign policy agenda. He has even proposed legislation that promotes clean energy that would create clean blue-collar jobs in his infrastructure proposals.Are you in favor, in principle, of that more aggressive approach?
That's a really hard question. I don't mind telling you that I have been disappointed with what we've seen coming from President Biden. It's very partisan. Much of it is in the category of kind of what I would say is the extremism. And I represent a county, and it's called Carbon County. He's not, these jobs he's talking about, they can't touch and feel and see them. They don't like it when somebody from Washington, D.C. says, I'm going to teach you how to code. They're worried about their futures and the futures of their kids. And without actually getting into that community and understanding what this transition and how brutal this transition is for them, it's really hard for Washington to mandate these solutions. And I think we've done a really terrible job of reaching out to communities that are in transition and showing them that we truly care about them. These are good men and women. And in many ways, they bore the brunt of the Industrial Revolution on their backs, both with safety and health and working conditions. And I think we owe them a little bit more than that.
Congressman Curtis, turning to the world stage, the United States and China together represent almost 40% of global emissions. And on his first day in office, as you know, President Joe Biden reversed former President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, to which China has signed on. Are you in favor of the United States returning to the Paris Climate Accord?
Well, let's just break it down just a little bit. You say that we're responsible for 40%, but we know the U.S. is responsible for less than 15%. That means that China is responsible for a whopping amount of greenhouse gas emissions, far in excess of what's coming out of the United States. And the Paris Accord not only tells them they don't have to cut back, but allows them to increase their emissions for the next 20 years. So, of course, I've got concerns about that. If you're again, let me come back to this concept of what really matters is worldwide greenhouse gas emissions. And the Paris Accord fails in cutting worldwide greenhouse gas emissions because we don't hold China accountable. And as a matter of fact, we let them continue to increase their emissions for the next two decades. Now, it depends on who you listen to, but it'll be too late in two decades when China finally gets around, if they ever get around, to cutting their emissions. I think we've got to be more honest about the science in this. And the science tells us that China must engage immediately.
And so you don't think that the Paris Accord does enough to pressure them?
Yeah. I mean, it in the accord, it lets them continue to increase their emissions for 20 years. How can anybody think that that's enough?
Is there a difference between how the accord treats China vis-a-vis the United States or India, for example, or any other large CO2 emitters?
Yeah, so we talk about China a lot, but India must be in the conversation. Russia must be in the conversation. I think one of the reasons that we are a little tougher on China is their kind of refusal to be part of worldwide solutions. I don't know that we're sensing that same thing, for instance, from India. But we've got to be realistic about the economy on the ground in India. We have people cooking with wood. That's a terrible thing for carbon emissions, right? So let's work with India, particularly, who'd be willing to work with us. And this is a really good example where we could use fossil fuels to dramatically lower greenhouse gas emissions coming from India and increase their quality of life in a substantial way by moving them from these wood stoves or coal-burning stoves to natural gas.
I would like to return to China, Congressman Curtis. You know, it's a huge challenge for the United States. Beijing is challenging democracy around the world. What do you think is the best way for the United States to approach its relationship with China, especially when Washington has to work with them to combat climate change, even as they commit human rights abuses, for example, against the Muslim Uyghur population in Xinjiang? And what about their crackdown on Hong Kong democracy activists?
Boy, I'll tell you, Carol, both of those points break my heart, and I've been very close to this. Your listeners may remember I speak Mandarin Chinese. I lived over in the Orient for 3 years and have watched very carefully what's happening with the Uyghurs and with Hong Kong, and it is not good. And I was served on the China Task Force last year here in Congress, and this is an oversimplification, but Many people feel like we should sever our relationship with China, that we should decouple our relationship. And if you compare this to a marriage, I'm proposing we don't need a divorce, but we do need marriage counseling, right? The relationship is not healthy.
Yeah.
And it's not a healthy relationship. And the trajectory is not a good trajectory. And there's I think in my mind, a heavy burden on President Biden's shoulders on this. This may be one of the very most important things he does. And you can view that from a climate perspective. You can view that from a human rights perspective. You can view that from an economic perspective, right? Almost any lens you put on, this is a serious problem for President Biden and one for which, he needs all of us to help him move the trajectory to improve this relationship. We don't have the luxury of having a bad relationship with China. We must fix this relationship, but it is very, very broken.
So do you have any specific policy recommendations that you would encourage the Biden administration to take towards China?
You know, I was originally a big critic of President Trump's tariff approach. And I've been pleased, actually, in hindsight now, that President Biden has not changed that very dramatically. That helps us hold an upper hand. One of the things I think that's too often overlooked is that the stronger our relationship is with other countries, the more we're able to change our China relationship. So continuing to strengthen trading ties, like doing things like the new MCA with Mexico and Canada, and getting back into trade agreements with our other, allies around the world, all of those things will strengthen our hand as we deal with China. And we've got to have partners in this around the world, and a lot of partners that have the type of influence that's needed with China.
I guess you must be heartened somewhat then in the aftermath of President Biden's trip to Europe with the EU partners and NATO. They seem to be more in sync on China as a threat and work perhaps together.
You know, I think that's true. And we haven't talked a little about COVID. There's still a lot we don't know about COVID and its origins. But I think in many ways, COVID has awoken a lot of our partners around the world to say, look, we've got to understand what's happening over there in China. I think a lot of Americans are now understanding some of the things that you've talked about, with the human rights violations and some of the other things that are happening over there, to realize that the relationship's not as healthy as many people thought that it was.
Congressman John Curtis, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us.
好的，我们感谢美国之音记者卡斯蒂尔的采访。来宾发表的是个人观点，并不代表美国之音。接下来，在中共百年大庆之际，中共最高领导人强调，中共的成功在于控制新冠、减少贫困和压服香港意义。从青少年时期开始力挺香港的美国青年莫志伟 Trevor Klein 认为，中共制服了香港的政治意见，却把自己的集权画风在世界面前暴露无遗。现在我们邀请美国大学生莫志伟参加美国之音的时事大家谈，请他分享他如何支持香港抵抗中国的经历，并且谈谈他选择 这么做的原因何在。Hi, Trevor, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you? Thank you for having me.
I'm pretty good. It's my honor. And actually, as I remember, you're only 19 years old, but you already have a few years of experience of supporting the democracy movement in Hong Kong and the democratization in mainland China. And you have been making like documentaries. And so could you please update us on what you have been up to recently, Trevor?
Yeah, so as you were talking about, last year I released a documentary about the history of the Hong Kong protests from the handover leading up to 2019. So recently I've been like promoting that and trying to get it out to different film festivals and things like that. We've been in about 5 or 6 so far. We have one coming up later this month. It's July 21st or 24th, actually. It's the Anthem Libertarian Film Festival.So we're really excited for that. And it's been great trying to spread the story of Hong Kong and how the brave people there were fighting for freedom and are still are fighting for freedom. And we're trying to get that story out to the world.
Okay, good. And we hope you can attain what your aspiration leads you to. And then the next question I would like to ask you a little bit, like analyze a little bit. So according to the New York Times,And so basically, in Xi's discourse, crushing dissent in Hong Kong is a major aspect of success of the CCP. So the other two being tamping down COVID-19 and reducing poverty in China. So how do you look at the success of the party in Hong Kong?
Well, I mean, it's really interesting how he, I guess, defines success. By his definition, he's been successful, but...What that means for millions of people is the destruction of their freedom, the destruction of their lives. People have had to leave Hong Kong. People have been thrown in jail. They've been subjected to horrible, horrible things. So I don't really think that that is success. I think that's tyranny. And his definition of success has been destroying one country, two systems. It's been neglecting basic human rights. And it means success for him and the aspirations of the party, but it by no means means success for Hong Kong people.
Okay, so basically they're on the opposite direction of the word. So it's totally contrary to what the word is hoping for Hong Kong. And then the next one I would like to ask you, so with the pro-democracy newspaper, the Apple Daily shut down by the CCP, can we say, actually we see that there are limited means that the Western world can resort to help save the civilization in Hong Kong. So how do you look at that? And also what the world could have done to prevent what's happening in Hong Kong from happening? And also regarding Taiwan, so what do you think the world can do to prevent Taiwan from being the democracy Taiwan from being digested by autocracy and dictatorship?
Trevor. Well, I think in the case of Hong Kong, it's the West, I guess, made two main mistakes. First off, just the setup of the handover was really ridiculous. The idea that the British government expected the Chinese government to respect one country, two systems for 50 years was kind of a fantasy.And I don't think that anyone who really looked at the character of the Chinese Communist Party could have really believed that that would have worked. So I think that that deal should have either never have happened, which would have been what obviously I would have preferred. But at least there must have been some sort of mechanism in place to actually ensure that freedom and human rights would be respected in Hong Kong, and they weren't, and that led to the situation we have now. Second off, I think that the moves to allow immigrants from Hong Kong have been great, but other than that, I feel like politicians will often like tweet out thoughts and prayers and aren't really taking much tangible action to actually stand up to the CCP. When other regimes across the world do horrible things and break treaties,We see sanctions, we see serious repercussions, but we don't see that on the part of China. And there's a number of reasons for that. And I understand that there are economic interests tied in with all of this. But in the end, we have to stand up for human rights, and we can't let China just steamroll people in Hong Kong, do what they're doing in Xinjiang, which is absolutely terrible, and do what they will do soon in Taiwan. To answer your question, how do we stop what's happening in Taiwan? Well, the first problem is we haven't stood up to them in the past, and so they're not going to be afraid to go roll over Taiwan. I think that what we need to do is start just standing up to them now in general. We can't let China get off the hook so easily for COVID, regardless of the origin of COVID. And it looks more and more like it's possible that the virus came from the lab. But regardless of that, China was clearly not transparent, and they exacerbated the situation. And we cannot let them just get a free pass for that. They need to face some sort of international repercussions. And so we need to start now and show them that destroying lives of people around the world is not acceptable. And we'll send a message to them that if they go to Taiwan and they destroy the freedom of the people there, then the world will not accept them as legitimate state, a legitimate government that we want to interact with and do business with. So also with Taiwan, I think it's important that we in the West give them more legitimacy as a state. We need to officially acknowledge that Taiwan is in sovereign control of the island of Taiwan, which in the US, you know, we don't actually acknowledge that. While we've gotten a lot better about dealing with Taiwan, and now we are more transparent, and we actually go out and we talk to Taiwanese officials and things like that, we still haven't officially recognized them. And that's a big step. And the reason not to do that is we're worried about angering China. And in the end, we can't let bullies drive our policy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So actually you became interested in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and mainland China as a teenager. So how did that happen?
My first love, my first academic love was kind of economics. I was interested in different economic structures and things like that, economic history. And Hong Kong's a super interesting example as like a really free market economy, and seeing how Hong Kong boomed as a result of the economic freedoms that they had there. And that was honestly the way I first started looking at it. And then I was wondering, well, now that Hong Kong is in the hands of China, how is this all going to work out? And that led me kind of down the rabbit hole of looking into democracy movements in Hong Kong. And I grew to really admire the people there and really admire what they're doing. I think what's going on in Hong Kong, what has been going on in Hong Kong for a long time, and what's much harder to do now, it's really a pure fight for freedom and for good values. There's a clear right and a clear wrong, and doing anything but standing with the people of Hong Kong violates all principles of freedom and basic human rights. And so I honestly am just really inspired by all the people in Hong Kong and just everyone who stands up to the Chinese regime in general. It's becoming increasingly hard to do so these days for people in Hong Kong and for people around the world, because China's has their hands in everything. They're more and more involved, and it's not really always profitable to do so. But so it shows a lot of character. It shows a lot of backbone when people stand up for what's right when it comes to China.
So you have been to all these three places, and you have seen with your own eyes the difference. And so what about your family and parents? So are your parents supportive of your passion in Hong Kong and also the political affairs in China?
Yeah, I mean, as any parents, I think, would be, they're like concerned, and they're always worried, like, oh, like, this is dangerous. Why do you need to be doing this? All in all, they understand why I'm standing up for these things. They understand that I truly value the things that Hong Kongers, people in Taiwan, and people, dissidents in China are fighting for. And so they support me. They support that. My mother, she lived in Iran, and in 1979, she moved from Iran to the U.S. for college, and she was planning on going back for winter break. And she never returned to Iran because the Islamic regime took over. And so I think even though my mother is worried about me, she understands how important freedom is. She lost her country to it. And she doesn't want to see more people lose their freedom to it.
And then about your peers, do you also motivate your peers to join you, or do you feel they understand your like extracurricular activities and that kind of thing?
I mean, I feel like it's not really a traditional extracurricular activity like a debate team or a sports team or something like that. So I think they're like a little confused because like when I like some like a success for me, like getting into a film festival or something like that, isn't what success looks like to most of my friends and most of the people I'm around. But I, for the most part, they're supportive. I've gotten some friends to come out to events in the LA area and things like that. I actually, when I got into the Black Hills Film Festival, I had some friends over and we watched the documentary and they seemed to enjoy it. So I've been able to get the message out among my friends. They've had to listen to me talk about what's going on in Hong Kong and things like that. And I think that it does resonate with many of them. It's not in, as an American youth, you don't really have to think that much about defending these types of basic freedoms because they've kind of been ingrained in our culture for so long. But I think when you look at people in Hong Kong, you look at people in Taiwan, you realize what you take for granted in places like the United States, and it makes you really grateful.
You're right. Actually, in America, in the Western world, these are the like assumed rights of everybody. But this is totally different in China. Okay. So what about your future plans? So because I remember you said you are in, of course, you're into politics. And so you're going to be like run for something for the Congress or something in the future, or you're going to be staying in the like documentary business.
Yeah.
Political goal.
Uh-huh. Well, in the as far as short run plans, I'm going to get into. I have footage to make a second part of the documentary, a follow up, and I'm going to try to get that out by the end of the summer. Beyond that, I want to stay in the realm of journalism more. So maybe documentaries, writing. Writing for Claremont Independent, which is a school affiliated, not school, it's independent of the schools, independently funded, but it's run on the campuses of the Claremont colleges where I go to school. But I think I want to stay on the journalism side of it, not thinking of running for office or anything like that. But I like right now I'm working on a startup, which I really can't get into too much detail on. But it's basically the goal is to promote more objective reporting in the United States, because I think that's a major problem that we have here. When we look at the coverage of a lot of controversial events recently, it's hard to sift through a lot of information from a lot of people with perverse motives and the goal of that startup is to make a dent in that. And so I'll see how far I can get with that. But unfortunately, I can't get into too much detail now because we're still kind of in the early stages. But so, yeah, that's what's next for me. And I'm looking forward to continue working to promote freedom in Hong Kong, China, and press freedom around the world.
Thank you, Trevor, for sharing your experience and your insight. 好，各位观众朋友，由于时间的关系呢，今天的时事大家谈到这里就要跟你说再会了。我们非常感谢美国青年莫志伟接受我们的专访，来宾发表的是个人观点，并不代表美国之音。我们也感谢各位观众、听众和网友的收看和收听，我是宇宙，祝各位晚安，我们下次节目再会。